2FM with Owen McDermott.
That's Feel Good in Gorillaz on 2FM. I apologise for the premature cessation of this song, but as they say occasionally in showbiz, I've got a bigger name on the other line. Now, I have to say, it is rare. Rare that you get to chat to a bona fide musical legend, ladies and gentlemen. But joining me on the show right now is the inimitable, world-conquering, curly-maned, guitar-thrashing, ferocious, vice-defeating, superstar rock and roll sex god. Ladies and gentlemen, it's only Slash.
It's hard to live up to an introduction like that. That's pretty awesome.
Oh, well, you've retrospectively lived up to it, so it's all good, you know.
That's funny.
Hello, sir. What time is it in Los Angeles?
It is a little after 1:30.
1:30. Well, listen, it's an absolute pleasure. You are coming to Ireland. You're in the Three Arena on November 10th with the World on Fire tour. We're going to talk about that presently, but if I may, this is kind of purely self-indulgent. There's one thing. When I heard you're coming on the show, I said I have to just throw that at Slash, because you were a part of my musical education in so far as the first ever album I bought was Michael Jackson's Dangerous in 1991.
And oh, really?
To this day, my favourite track is Give In To Me, which you play guitar on.
Wow, I don't think anybody's ever told me that before.
And do you know what? It's if people are unaware, I'm just going to give this 10-second blast. That is a feeling. That is Michael Jackson, Give In To Me with Slash. That song, to this day, is my favourite Michael Jackson song, and you on it. What a collaboration, man. I just think it's absolutely amazing.
Oh, thanks, man. That was a fun session and interesting experience all around.
What are your memories of Michael when you think back on that time? Because that was, like, for me, between, obviously, Bad and Dangerous was, I think, you know, him in his prime, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, he was obviously, you know, a megastar when I as far as I was concerned, when I first got the phone call, I was a little bit taken aback, to be honest. And I went down to the studio and met him down there, and he was really just a very genuinely nice, easygoing guy. And we didn't really hang out for very long. He let me have full reign of the studio, and he took off, and then we started hanging out. We started doing a lot of performances after that, pretty globally, you know, like Spain and Germany and New York and Japan and this and that and the other. And he was just cool, man. One of these kind of artists that you work with and you really realize, you know, when somebody talks about sort of a gift from on high for what it is that they do, you know. And it was really a lot of fun, and he was cool, so I have nothing but high praise for him.
Awesome. Yes, it's really incredible. Yeah, like I said, it's still my favorite song to this day. But you now, in your current incarnation, because you've been through several, this is the World on Fire tour, and you've got Miles and Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators with you on this record. And I kind of wonder, in terms of collaborating, are you a bit of a dictator, or are you kind of a more democratic collaborator?
I'm definitely not the dictator type. I'm pretty collaborative. In this situation, it's the sort of, I come up with ideas for songs and stuff from wherever, and I share them with Miles, and if it looks like he's got a vocal melody to go along and he seems excited about it, then I work it out with Brent and Todd the rest of the song, and, you know, it really works out great the way that we do it. And it's something that's been evolving from, really, since Miles and I first started working together when I did my first solo record, and then we did the Apocalyptic Love, and it started to really take shape, and I think it's evolved pretty nicely up till this point, you know.
Yeah. I saw a really interesting interview that you did, and you were kind of talking, you know, it was one of these state of the nation kind of interviews, and you said that music, on the whole, like, the music industry isn't catering to rock and roll, yet the appetite from the audience is still alive and well.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, blatantly apparent. But the industry is really become sort of a one-trick pony. It's, for the most part, it's all a certain kind of commercial music, and every different genre has all sort of had to funnel down into this one sort of top 40 style, and everything else sort of falls by the wayside. Record companies and so on aren't taking any risks with different types of artists, and, especially when it comes to rock and roll. So that's just the way that is at this point. I mean, there's always sort of peaks and valleys for rock and roll anyway, so I don't complain too much about it, but that seems to be the case. But when you're playing in front of an audience, there's a genuine kind of enthusiasm and passion for a good rock and roll band that's always been there. So it's very encouraging, you know?
Yeah, but I saw a quote and I laughed when I read it. You said, making music now, given the state of the industry, can't be about buying cars and getting laid.
Wait. I just heard the guitars are getting late. What?
Making rock and roll music now can't be about buying cars and
getting
laid.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, you have to do it for the love of the music, because that's the only thing that you're going to get out of it, really, at this moment in time, you know? So, and I think that's good. That's the healthy side of it, you know, is that it sort of separates the men from the boys as far as why people are, you know, getting into the business.
Yeah, yeah. And the way you've conquered your demons, which I think is kind of, you know, publicly known, that you live the rock and roll lifestyle and you're in a much kind of healthier place now. Do you think, because I read, some of your story, and I read recently Anthony Kiedis' autobiography, Scar Tissue, which is just, you know, it's hedonistic in the extreme. But do you think, kind of given, I don't know, your upbringing and your parents kind of were so artsy and you were in music from an early age and all these rock and roll band carnations, do you think that kind of lifestyle is an inevitable byproduct of being rock and roll? Because it's not like obviously exclusively a rock and roll thing, but it seems
I don't think it's a rock, just, I mean, rock and roll is, you know, as a term, I think it's sort of a loose term for a lot of things, you know. I mean, but that lifestyle is more something that you see it in rock and roll, but you see it in art, period. You know, if painters, actors, whatever, you know, anybody who's out to, it's in politics too a little bit, but anyway, anybody who's sort of like looking for, is into freedom of expression and wants to be, you know, just is wild by nature, I think, starts to fall into that sort of, and it's fun. I don't really have any complaints about it or regrets or anything like that. You know, I think I did so much of it that I just burned out on it. But it just wasn't conducive to getting anything done after a while, and so I had to move on.
Yeah, well, at least your priorities in order. That's good. Am I right to understand that originally the Miles and the Conspirators wasn't supposed to be the big tour it is now? It was a kind of let's suck it and see kind of affair.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it's just I didn't set out. I didn't have any set goals in mind for anything. I had done that solo record that had all the different vocalists on it, and and that was just a project, something that I'd wanted to do, and I went and did it, and I met Miles in the process, and he just seemed like I had this gut feeling that I wanted to do a tour to support the record. It was basically,
yeah,
and he seemed to me like the kind of guy that was talented enough and had the vocal range to be able to sing anything I threw at him, you know. So to do a set where I wanted to do something where I put all my sort of catalog in there, he just seemed like the guy. And so I started working with him, and we just got on really well. And he was capable of doing all that. And so we put together a band real quick, you know, and these were all different guys that I'd never met before, which was really odd considering I live in LA and I've played with everybody. But I got pointed in the direction of Brent Fitz, who was from Vegas, who I'd never heard of. And I started playing with him, and he was great. And then he introduced me to another Canadian-bred Las Vegas resident, which is Todd Kearns, and one of the best bass players I've ever worked with. And I was like, okay, well, let's go out and do this tour. And it was supposed to be like, oh, we'll do some dates here, there, and it'll, you know, probably a couple months tops. And it turned into a year and a half. And then I decided if I was going to make another record, I'd just do it with this group of guys, you know. And then it really started turning into a band, and we did Apocalyptic Love, and then went from there. So this is something that just sort of evolved out of nothing, really.
And when you mentioned your catalog there, what's that conversation go like in your head? Because obviously, like I said, you've had so many incarnations. There's your current form, there's Snake Pit, there's Velvet Revolver, and of course Guns N' Roses. So when you're saying in terms of pushing new music, but also I suppose people have an expectation, do you feel an obligation to fulfill that, or do you kind of say, no, I want to do what I'm doing now?
Well, that was just for the fun of it, just because a lot of that stuff I hadn't played in a long time. And also just to be able to do it, just to be able to sort of do it the way, however it was that I wanted to do it. I don't know. I didn't give it much thought. I just thought it would be a lot of fun to play like certain selections from each different band mixed in with whatever new stuff I had. And that was basically it. And it really was a blast to do, you know, maybe just cause I had been so long since I'd played, you know, Gun songs or Snake Pit songs or even Velvet songs for that matter. So we just went ahead and started doing that, and that just became sort of how the set was. And I would, you know, sort of write the set in the morning or in the afternoon before the show and change it around every day. And we've been doing it that way ever since.
Amazing. One question I would like to ask you. I'm sure you've probably been asked this question a lot overseas, but this is of particular interest to an Irish audience, I suppose, is the U2 iTunes thing, because the music industry is in such a turmoil, and you have, you know, you're still writing and recording, but you've played huge venues, world conquering venues, more intimate venues, and you know, still doing the type of music you do, and the big challenge is to get that music to the people when, right, you know, there's not a huge amount of radio play. And I just wondered what you thought of the U2 deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of mixed feelings about it, but I mean, when I first heard of it, I would say, God bless them, you know, U2 is in that position to be able to do that. And it worked out obviously for Apple or whatever, and it worked out hugely for U2, so, you know, all things considered, they're going to come out and do a massive tour, and they're just so set up that you can't compare them to anybody else. So whatever works for them is great. I don't have any issue with it. Everybody got the U2 record that has iTunes, so I think that works out pretty well.
Yeah, fair enough, I suppose.
You get to be a band in that kind of stratosphere, you know, you start coming up with unique ways. You have to come up with unique ways to do things, even over and above, you know, some of the younger artists or more struggling artists or whatever. I think people don't even realize that. But so you got to come up with cool shit. There you go.
Yeah, fair enough. As on a final note, any particular fond memories of Ireland because you're returning?
Well, the last time I was there, actually, was the last shows of our European tour on the Apocalyptic Love tour, and it was killer. And I'm just looking forward to coming back. That was those were memorable gigs. We had two of them, and it was just a lot of fun. So I'm just looking forward to coming back.
Oh, and Mr. Sheen showed up in support, I think, as well. Yeah, that caused a bit of a flurry.
Well, he showed up and introduced us.
Anyone who have Charlie Sheen introducing very quickly, obviously you have your established audience slash, but you'll be delighted to know that we've got a text in saying my 8-year-old daughter Evine is sitting at the kitchen table impatiently waiting to hear slash she loves him and was very annoyed when she discovered she's too young to go to the concert in November. So there you go, you're picking up young fans too, and the usual bout of adoration.
We need them, because we need this next generation to sort of change the state of things, you know.
So yeah, yeah. Well,
very encouraging and very. I'm all for that. That's cool.
They are here and they are listening. And also Catherine Thomas, who presents the show The Voice here, has just tweeted saying she wants to kiss you on the lips. So you can take that or leave that.
That's all good.
Slash is in the Three Arena, Dublin, November 10th. Ticketmaster.ie. Man, I can only thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
No, it's been nice talking to you, and sort of exciting because we're getting close to those dates, and it just reminds me that it's coming up right around the corner. So,
well,
awesome.
I'll certainly see you there. This is World on Fire, on Fire Slash. Thank you so much.
All right, man. Cheers.
Cheers. 2FM with Owen McDermott.